Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. We, the people, must continue to learn, pray, and act if we're going to appeal to heaven and seek his blessing and seek his power in assisting in restoring our constitutional republic. On top of that, the whole point, folks, is full compliance to the Constitution. It's not that difficult. I go through how we have an enumerated Constitution. They only have very specific powers. And so we're also working on a script so that you can take a script and go and sit in front of your county commissioners and provide them with, we're trying to make this 15 minutes, because 9 times out of 10, you can get a 30-minute presentation. And so we want to keep it to about 15 minutes so that at the very end, we're going to present them with detailed topics that you will then be able to come back and give them further details if they're not ready to pull the trigger. In other words, there could be, you could actually have the blessing of dealing with somebody like Wes McCart, former commissioner for Stevens County, who was the one that actually carried the torch that really didn't necessarily need the requirement. I mean, I provided them with 2 one-hour presentations to just to get the ball rolling. And, of course, I was using kind of an howitzer approach instead of giving them a high level. Had I gone down this path of high level, we might have actually been able to just get the resolution started 3 years ago while Wes was midterm. But instead, towards the end, not knowing I did those presentations and not knowing that there was a huge move afoot to get rid of their only constitution. And the people that supported the removal of Wes McCart made all sorts of hyperbole comments like, oh, he's violated the Constitution. I mean, it was all ad hominem. It was all personal. And I get the fact that I'm not necessarily a easy Ted, I'm not this teddy bear politician. Not that I would want to or not want to kiss, babies, that type of stuff. But the bottom line is, Wes McCart, actually stood his ground. And he didn't go, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, like a sycophant to the voters when he was in front of them. And so he tried to help them understand, what was going on. And so it's interesting because I was actually in a large meeting of commissioners. And here's former commissioner Wes McCart telling all of the commissioners the details of the problems that they're facing from the tyranny from Washington State. And I'm going, wow, I mean, he's still, whoever he's representing in these meetings, he looks great. It's just for some reason they wanted to get Monty Stobart in to replace him. He was the first, and I it was like anybody but. So they grabbed this guy that doesn't know that much. And as a matter of fact, I don't want to grind an axe here, but Stevens County was on track of having bylaws and having a committee formed well before now. But because Monty ended up winning the election, there have been people that have been trying to kill this committee because they actually tried to do it in a meeting by challenging the veracity of what they did. And come to find out, that was a nonsensical challenge, that they were well within their powers of how they did it. They didn't violate the state laws or anything else. So it's just like, I'm going, what the heck's going on? I mean, why is Stevens County not there yet? We've got other counties in the state of Washington moving forward, and that's all because of Michelle. That's why I said it is truly a blessing to work with people that are willing to carry the ball, people that are willing to just take a stand. And it's, I would much rather see somebody take a stand and not be accurate with what they're saying because they're still learning. But, for the most part, they're getting it right. They're basically saying, we've got to do this. if you want to go through the details, I mean, even things I say, somebody could easily go nitpicking, because I don't have a polished, you know, script here. I do not read something that has been completely vetted so that there, you know, you can't find a problem. I may mix words, mix names, I mispronounce names. You can count on that. But what we do want to do, because I kind of finished the obligatories, there's actually two things I need to still say. We need to start demanding full compliance, wrap that up, that it's all about full compliance with the Constitution, getting our government to be in compliance to the Constitution delegated to them. In other words, when we create a government, we create a constitution, which is why we have to have county constitutions. I also want to remind you, because it's been a long time, that if you would like to start pushing the issue of restoring a true electoral college and getting the popular vote crap out of the party's hands and back to a true constitutional choosing of the president, then you can count on me to be, you know, the guy you can vote for if you become an elector outside of the party. I mean, the parties can still, you know, they can still select me. You don't have to be a candidate on that ballot. In other words, there's really no ballot. There is really, the only standard for a president is you got to be naturally born. You have to be of 45 years or whatever the age is. And so the point is that the name doesn't, the presidential candidate, does that name doesn't go on the ballot. The electors are the ones that choose it. And so the electors are responsible for ensuring that that person is actually qualified. We've had the parties continually vote and support people that weren't qualified. That's right. We need to stop this. I mean, we've actually seen in this past election with Trump having to campaign against two people that weren't qualified, Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy. Why was the party even allowing their names to even be there? They should just be established as candidates for the Republican Party. And I am a candidate for the Constitution. Not the Constitution Party, not the Republican Party, not the Libertarian Party. I am a candidate for the Constitution. I don't have a party. I have no affiliations with parties. I have no platform other than full compliance to the Constitution. The only thing we're going to do is make sure that Congress doesn't spend a penny on anything that they have no authority to spend money on. They're all, this would get rid of everything, folks. It would actually restore all things back. And so when people start looking at, oh, well, how are we going to pay? We will stop paying off that debt. We will stop paying off that debt as soon as the states actualize the fact that the federal government is violating the Constitution by spending, by all these things that they formed and created. Then instantly we'll stop paying that debt. The Federal Reserve goes away. Folks, you need to start understanding that to get back to constitutional, we got to get back to gold and silver currencies as well. And what do we need to do to get there? Okay, so there will be some upheaval because of the shenanigans that they play. But the states should not actually, you know, have to, you know, make many changes other than they need to downscale as well. Downscale significantly because your state is exercising powers they're not supposed to be exercising. Will they erase our roads? No. Will they erase anything? No. Everything that's there was done fraudulently, but we don't have to pay for it. The people that need to pay, they will be held accountable. In other words, when these nations want, you know, hey, we want to hold these people accountable because these nations are equally culpable. They're equally responsible. They should have known that the debt they were paying for was fraudulent. The federal government, whoever was ones that were basically outselling debt, saying, we got some debt to buy, you want to buy some of our debt? Those people were equally culpable. All the people that authorized it, Obama, whomever. Therefore, and this is why, this is where my apprehension with Trump. He actually signed up for debt. He's been paying debt. as a constitutional president, you can't do that. That debt has to be legitimate, and I know it's not. What I need, and this is the only thing, I mean, we're not going to be adding anything to the debt, and I'm going to basically be, because I gave you the 13-part series of what a constitutional president would do. So go read that or go listen to that. But if you want to get there, I will be willing. I mean, as long as the Lord keeps me vertical, I'll be willing to do everything I can to get this constitutional framework back in place. Anyway, so one of the things I need to get back to, and we're going to get back to, closing out the Lands Acts that created the public lands. Okay, we'll get back to that. And I am working in getting all the documentation fixed and up on the website. So, and I just found out that the Tory Acts, was that link was dead. We fixed that this weekend. So as you see things changing, if we've got a link there, the document should be there. But we're trying to give you everything that becomes the evidence of the Ponzi scheme. And so we're trying to put everything down into that perspective so that as you read through these things, you can kind of see, you know, okay, so here's some legitimate stuff, but this is where they were deliberately setting up a Ponzi scheme and doing this development of the national infrastructure all unconstitutionally without creating a Department of Transportation. As Madison, even Monroe, and even Andrew Jackson told them they needed to do that. It's interestingly enough that Monroe actually knew that they were doing something different. And I just think that maybe when Monroe vetoed that, and I think Jackson's the same. I think both of those presidents knew that, oh, well, we've already found a different mechanism in creating the infrastructure, so I'm going to look good like James Madison. I'm going to veto this. Madison was not on board. I do not believe Madison actually, because there's no way he saw this Ponzi scheme coming. He saw Congress go a little beyond by applying the Northwest Ordinance. They used that language in the Illinois Enabling Act. Not Illinois, Indiana. And so anyway, let me dive into what I was ranting about on Friday. Because folks, we need to really look at our perspective of what we have for our supreme law of the land and what we have, because I kind of dove down these paths, right? And you hear people in the secession camp. And so I focus really most of my time regarding the secession camp. These folks that believe that, you know, these general assemblies are legitimate, that people have the ability to, you know, create shadow governments or, you know, and people do have a legitimate way of becoming a state's national. If that, whatever you want to call it, technically the legal term that was established by the framers is an inhabitant. You know, they have all these other twisted legal terms, but the technical term that was established by the framers was inhabitants. People who were able to be, you know, here, they had land and those types of things. They were inhabitants, but they weren't citizens. So they weren't paying taxes. They couldn't vote. And the law didn't necessarily not apply to them, but the protections did not apply. Because that's why the Constitution kept on stating every time that an amendment was, you know, that voting rights for any black person would be protected if they were a U.S. citizen or for any race. No person could not be denied the ability to vote because of their race. If they were a U.S. citizen, they had a right to vote. Any woman that wanted to vote, she could, you know, she had to be a U.S. citizen. She couldn't be an inhabitant. Didn't matter. You had to be a U.S. citizen. All U.S. citizen women had the right to vote. All U.S. citizens could not be stopped from voting by a poll tax. In other words, you didn't have to pay a poll tax to vote anymore. But you still had to be a citizen. And then all citizens 18 years of age had the right to vote. But you had to be a citizen. So inhabitants which, you know, these people who go through this legal process. Now, I want to be clear here. Maybe 1 out of 100, there are people that are literally being decimated by the courts, by government, by tyranny. They're literally finding that they're losing their property, they're losing their family through a divorce or what have you, where, you know, because there's cases out there that just boggle my mind. But what ends up happening is, you know, one of the spouses, typically that's the woman, that goes into this protection because they're told by liberal social workers, and anybody that's a social worker, you have to place in the liberal camp. But these are ideologue liberals. Now, by the way, the only way we're going to actually restore anything is people have to become ideologically focused, or you need to get into what we call the ideological camp. You have to start believing that this is what we have to do. You have to become convinced, convicted. You have to have this firm foundation that this is what has to happen. Go look up ideologue, because it seems like the United States used to be filled with nothing but ideologues. And now the only ideologues that exist, unfortunately, are conservatives and communists. And conservatives are basically I'd almost say the conservatives are just moral communists versus the immoral communists. So basically, all of our ideologues are communists. We have moral communists who vote Republican. And then we have immoral communists who vote Democrat. That is the nuances of our political system. For those people that are rabid about what they want to control the curriculum for moral purposes, making sure that there's no immorality in the education system. But they still want to brainwash your kids where that authority is not within the government's power. They still want to basically make sure that, you know, the healthcare system is moral and not supporting the immorality of blah, you know, gender reassignments, that's a. So, I mean, they're basically two sides of the same coin. You've heard this before, but most people I don't think anybody's really created that context that they're both communists, they're both fascists. It's not fascist because, that's moral fascism. Well, you're doing immoral fascism because you're doing the exact same thing. Folks, this has been proven now. I mean, so for years going into the 60s, the fascist communists, you couldn't prove that they were fascists. We just want tolerance. We want free love. We want blah. But now that they have access to the mantle of power, they have proven to be equally fascists. You can't say anything otherwise. So anyway, let me get back to, you know, really where we are, right? Because there's too many people that have a inappropriate paradigm of our constitutional republic. Because everybody on the conservative side, and again, these are going down the path. I'm not dealing with the communists, liberal communists, immoral communists. There are those in the moral communist camp who believe that the Bible is the supreme law of the land, that the Constitution was based on the Bible, and that the Bible is the supreme law. No. The Constitution is the supreme law. The framers were definitely biblical. The framers were definitely trying to ensure that there would be no, and what I just want to make this clear, there was no slant towards any denomination of a religion. The concept of freedom of religion was paramount. No person could be forced, and that's why at the federal level, that's the standard that was created. Even though the majority of the people at the time really wanted to have a Christian federal government, they all realized that, you know, and as a matter of fact, if I sat down, and when we go into break, I will come up and I will match up those eight states that had state-sponsored churches. And then I will tell you, out of the Anglican Church, what the population of those five states were, and then give you the total population of the United States to basically show you that I believe the majority of the people in the Republic were Anglican. I'm just taking a guess here because I've never done this before, but I'm going to do this when we go to break. So that when we come back, I'll actually be able to tell you, see, if they would have had a popular vote, they would have actually, because they, the thing that protected you from having this draconian church, the English or the Episcopal Church, of being the standard church for the United States. You just, you know, you got to remember, this basically pulls us back under Britain's umbrella. And so the reason this didn't happen is because each state being a party has equal voice over that constitution. It is not a democracy. So in other words, the true republican form of government, where the sovereigns, not the people, where the sovereigns, because if it was the people who were the sovereigns, only the people, then the popular vote would have applied. So folks, put that in your pipe and puff it. Because bottom line, we have a true republican form of government where the sovereigns, the governments we create. So this is why this is applicable at the federal constitution as well as the state constitution. That the counties have, and being the parties to the state constitution, the only reason we're going to be able to save ourselves in this entire system is because each state has one voice. That is the standard. And each county has one voice. That is the standard of our republic. Because they are the parties to the compact. As Madison laid this out in the report on the Virginia resolutions, there can be no greater authority than the parties. And even though everybody wants to say, well, the people created the states, I'm telling you, so go look for yourself, and we'll all recognize that there were delegates from the county that created every state. That's how it went. And even though the dummies, these illiterate, constitutionally illiterate delegates, actually went and invoked democracies and so forth, and this is because even Congress was so illiterate that they didn't care. Well, it's Republican in form. That's good enough. And we just kept on sliding more and more towards democracy because nobody understood this basic principle that the sovereigns are represented in this republic, which is why we have bicameral legislative bodies. The people of the county is represented in the House, and the county itself is represented in the Senate. In other words, the county government is represented in the Senate. And at the federal level, the people of the state are represented in the House. And the state government itself is represented in the Senate. This is why we prove this regarding the 17th Amendment and so forth. So you can't refute this. So when we come back, I'm going to give you the numbers because I've got basically about less than a half a minute here. When we come back, I'll give you those numbers regarding, you know, what the population would have been, because I honestly think that there's probably enough Anglicans, because there were a few states that were non-denominational, meaning there was probably the Anglican Church which was operating there. So, you know, that's the silent numbers that we don't even see. But just based on the numbers of these, you know, four or five states that were Anglican, I think that it was that close to where I believe they would have actually created a national Anglican church. And so is that what we want? Absolutely not. And now there's so much, we've even gone further and further away from a single majority faith, a single majority doctrine. But we still have these idiots that say we want to have this biblical-based constitution. And then again, the problem is whose Bible? Because that's where the arguments begin and why we can't get along. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, well, the states have been tabulated, and we've come up with a decision. Now, as I look at the eight churches, or eight states that had churches, there were three that were non-denominational, or I should say congressional. Oops, congregational, that's what I meant, congressional. Congregational. Now, the three states, interestingly enough, two of the three came out of Massachusetts, because, as you've probably heard me say, Connecticut was created because Massachusetts kicked out a blasphemer who was teaching apostasy, and they created a new congressional form of, and I think that might have been the Baptist Church. And then New Hampshire was another one where they kicked somebody out, and New Hampshire became a state. And so when we add up, and keep in mind that these are actually divided into three separate faiths, even though they're congregational, you can't add all of these as a total sum. And you're looking at 750,000 people, 758,000, okay, out of these three. Now, the rest of the eight states all the rest of them were Anglican. And it was Maryland, South Carolina, Virginia, New York, and North Carolina. And I will tell you that when you look at Rhode Island and you look at the other states, the only other state that was really probably not leaning more towards the Anglican faith was Pennsylvania, because that's where the Amish, and that's where a lot of, you know, Pennsylvania was one of those states that was really heavily focused on religious freedom, which is one of the reasons why they didn't gravitate towards a single faith. Now, New Jersey, Georgia, and Delaware, they actually did gravitate towards the Anglican faith. They just wanted to be, you know, separated. By the time the Constitution came along, they were really supporting more towards religious freedom, where they kind of severed that relationship. Going into the Constitution, eight states maintained a symbiotic relationship, and those are the eight I gave you. So if I add up the total of the Anglican Church, that comes to almost 2 million people, 1,994,000 people. Now, if I add up the total of the United States at that point in time, it comes to 3.5 million, a little over 3, let's just see, 3.6 million. So 1.9 million Anglicans versus what? Well, so let me pull up the, because I'm doing math in my head, and my head is not there. So I said 3.6 million minus 1.9 million. That means that it was 1.7 million that got, you know, was the other vote. So in other words, if it was a democratic process, the United States would have been Anglican. You have the facts. I'm not even adding those other states. I'm giving all of those other states that had Anglican presence in Delaware, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and definitely Georgia. I mean, Georgia was established by the crown as a relief to their as a penal colony and a relief to their penal system. They let basically the white collar crime criminals out to go as indentured servants and, you know, start anew in America. So because it was really ran by the state, I believe that Georgia was actually far more Anglican, if not all Anglican. I'm not adding them, because there was only 68,000 in Georgia. It was a strategic state. Folks, all the Christians, the evangelicals, born-again, Baptists, what have you, would you have been happy today if all of a sudden you wouldn't be able to practice your faith because they decided to go Anglican and they used a democratic process? The point that I'm trying to make is that the design of the Constitution guaranteed and ensconced religious freedom for those people who sought individual liberty and religious freedom. Any person that is a citizen of the United States and they do not support your religious freedom, then they should be stripped of their citizenship because they shouldn't be able to vote. We need to ensure and guarantee the paradigm of religious freedom will always be preserved. Therefore, if you try to vote against religious freedom, you lose, or you try to invoke theocracies that will take away religious freedom, any type of theocracy like that. And what are the two theocracies that do this? Islam and communism. Ah, now you see the two churches, the two ideologues that are actually out to destroy America. Do you believe that the people in the deep state understood this? Absolutely. And they knew the communists couldn't get there fast enough, which is why they started importing Mohammedans. And now we see Mohammedans violating the supreme law of the land because they're establishing bastions where religious freedom is stepped on. In any of these areas that say you can't buy pork, you can't have bacon, you can't eat your bacon, you can't sell bacon in that district because of religious standards, that right there is antithetical to the Constitution and repugnant to the letter of the law. Therefore, folks, when we look at Mohammedans and we look at communists, people who want statist ideologies, they want to implement statist ideologies, then we need to take away their votes. If you want to preserve America, because this is how we get back to true liberal-minded, where people are free religiously, okay? So now let's dive down this concept, because this is where I have to kind of revisit what I got into details on Friday. Now, I've been meaning to basically conclude, because I thought I concluded, those land acts that basically created public land. There were three of them, and I almost got through that last Monday, a week ago. And anyway, so I will get back into that. But here's the thing. In England, common law was based on the Bible, and that they were a theocracy, and their church was the Anglican Church. And the people that were living in England, if they weren't supporting the Anglican Church, they were oppressed. Just like the people in Virginia were being oppressed. Any Baptist that was trying to a proselyte for their faith, any other person that was trying to proselyte for anything other than the Anglican Church would end up finding themselves in jail and fined and punished. So, as we look at common law in America, common law was absolutely shifted away from the government, which is why the federal Constitution did not establish common law as the legal system. It established constitutional law, which is why when we read the first, when we dive into the jurisdiction of the court system in America. It literally, and I go over this, I say this, and you hear me say this all the time. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority, period. That is their judicial power. Now, it also extends to all cases affecting ambassadors and public ministers and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime. So those things are outside the Constitution. In other words, the chancery law and or the admiralty law, as well as, or and basically admiralty law and chancery law, same. Maritime law is the law on the sea and the commerce and so forth. So everything else here in this, as far as this jurisdiction, it says to controversies which the United States shall be party. In other words, and or to controversies between two or more. So if the United States is a party to, can they be a party to somebody who committed murder? No. They can be a party to somebody who committed treason against the Constitution because they have original jurisdiction over that. They're the same thing with committing counterfeiting. Those are the only two laws that they have original jurisdiction over. So any other crime you commit, this is why we're going through the ratification debates. This is why Madison, literally, last week we stated this. Or actually, no, I'm sorry. We pre-recorded, so it's coming up this week. So Madison's actually going to come say, you know, I don't think that maybe only 1 out of 100 cases will actually go to the federal courts the way it's designed. Because whatever crime you commit, there's no way you can go into the federal courts because even at the appeal level, it should never transcend because they don't have jurisdiction over crime unless it's those two. But the judiciary, and this is where we got into a debate and a call with, I don't know what the individual's, you know, affinity is, but I know that they're anti-constitution as defined by the framers, and they seem to be, and it's kind of ironic how, because I'm perceiving that this person's maybe more of a state's national, and I could go to Woody and say, well, how would you classify this guy on Friday's call? And he'd probably say, yeah, probably a state's national. So anyway, here's a person that's telling me that the Supreme Court basically said no state can secede from the Union. What? And so, in other words, they're using, because they want to go after the 14th Amendment. And so I believe when you really are dealing with people that tend to, you know, they don't have an actual academic standard. Their standard is whatever I can use to support my narrative. And so that becomes very problematic. So when it comes to common law, and when I talk to these kinds of folks, 9 times out of 10, they're going to gravitate towards, because a lot of these people who are general assemblies and so forth, a lot of them are people that want a biblically based constitution. Do you understand what I'm saying? They actually want to go away from this constitution that protects your rights and actually inflict upon others very specific paradigms. So that only these people, only the people that are using this Bible and faith, they're those are the only ones that are protected. In other words, they think that they're going to go down and create a much better constitution than what the Lord gave us. And you know, what a bunch of idiots. Forgive me. But only an idiot thinks that they're going to do better than, you know, our Creator and, you know, His Son. What they have given us is the best. There's no doubt in my mind, there's nothing better. As a matter of fact, I'll even go farther than the framers. I believe that this Constitution is perfect. Those compromises that they injected regarding slavery was an unsavory taint that basically was an indictment against the paradigms of the men at the time. But all that being said, this gentleman that wanted to say that states, you know, couldn't secede. He said, well, that means if a state can't secede from the union, actually what he says is a state cannot secede. If they can secede from the union, then he says that ought to be in the Constitution. Well, how does a state get admitted into Congress? Does the federal government admit a state? Because this, after thinking about this, I go, well, let's look at the process. Do the people wait for Congress to come along and say, we're scooping you in, you're going to become a state? No. The people in the territory have to believe that they're ready. See, Congress was pushing the boundaries, and they were basically trying to set low standards just to get states into the union. And back in those days, the federal government wasn't costing trillions of dollars. Back in those days, the government wasn't hardly doing anything. They were just growing and growing and growing. So when we, and actually they started a Ponzi scheme in the early 1800s. I mean, they were doing things they shouldn't have been doing. But bottom line, a state, the people actually have to choose to form. Because even if you read the Enabling Act, if the people do not choose to establish a constitution, then it maintains itself as a territory. Now, technically, while that state or that area of the territory is, again, a territory, Congress has the ability to disposition it by trading that in a treaty to another nation so that we can acquire land or get something else to benefit the Union. As long as that territory has not been transitioned into a state, the federal government can make all needful rules, regulations, and dispositions regarding it. That's what the Constitution says. But once the people choose to form a state, at any point in time, they can vacate and step out of the Union. And at that point, they become an independent state. And that is the danger of the Union if people or if states actually start stepping out of the Union. The real problem is the measure for stepping out, because this is laid out by Madison, for a person or for a state to seek interposition and or nullification. What does that mean? Interposition means that as a state, you are seeking a redress of grievances to get the federal government, the general government, and the union into compliance to the Constitution. In other words, they're demanding compliance. Interposition is where a state is taking a stand and saying, you must comply. A state that doesn't like the violations of the Constitution, as Jefferson stated, and even Madison supported, that any state that says you're violating this Constitution, and because it is one material and willful, we are stepping out. And they can actually sever their relationship. So it is the fault of the federal government and the union for not being in compliance that they will actually lose that state, and that state becomes an independent state. Now, when it comes to an independent state, does the United States have the ability to wage war against an independent state? Well, yeah, they can, but they have to declare war first. Instead, Lincoln declared war, Lincoln declared martial law, and then Lincoln disbanded Congress. Ergo, what happened with the South was all wrong. The federal government couldn't say you can't leave the Union. That was Lincoln that said that. The Constitution doesn't say you can't step out of this Union. It only has the mechanism of how states, the individuals, must seek to become a state. And when they do and they choose to create that state becomes an equal party to the compact. They're not a subject to the compact. The only subject to the compact is the federal government. Now, the states actually are, just to be clear here, the states and the federal government both have some subjectivity, or they are subjects to the compact regarding restrictions, because the Constitution does restrict states from doing certain things. And if you don't like those things, well, then that's tough. But when the federal government is violating the Constitution, you have a right to step out. Now, this goes back to a very deep conversation I had, and I know this is going to confuse people, but it's worth, I need to state it, one, because it's there. It would be disingenuous for me, while I'm covering this, to not actually give you the better picture. So, when we look today at the Union and the Constitution, every state that is up in arms over the federal government violating the Constitution, all these states have the authority to step out, to nullify the laws and become independent states. Now, does the federal government have the ability to wage war upon those states? Absolutely not. They'd have to declare war, but there better be a good willful reason to actually send the children of these parents off into these states to fight warfare. Now, with Lincoln could have used the Monroe Doctrine to say, you guys are practicing slavery. And we with the Monroe Doctrine, find that an abomination, and we are not allowing slavery to be allowed anywhere in the North, the Western Hemisphere. And on North America, we're going to start with North America. So he could have actually started waging war to end slavery, but not to actually force these states back into the Union. He couldn't do that. It's almost like this idea of, I'm going to grab you by the hair, drag you into the water, and I'm going to save you so that you can go to heaven. You can't do that. Christ is not going to accept that person in heaven that was, baptized under their will. And Congress should not do that either. Even if the president has won the war, they can't do that. When they've stepped out, they have to have themselves request to be allowed back in, and then they have to create a new constitution. Now, if they want their old constitution, they can have their old constitution. But they have to submit a constitution that is Republican in form. Congress does not have any authority within that constitution, nor the constitution has ever been amended, to dictate what a state must put in their constitution. It only must be Republican in form. That's the only thing they can mandate. They were mandating things that they should have been mandating. Well, actually, some of it makes sense, like language and so forth. But Christian, and I think when they were looking at Christian, they were having some real hard times, because basically when you looked at the California and some of the southern states that were being settled by Mexico or had lots of Mexican influence and people settling like in California, they were Catholic. And so Congress kind of, that's Catholic. We don't consider that Christian. So I think they were kind of crossing the boundaries a little bit by, going down that religious side. But nevertheless, people are people. They're going to, make their mistakes based on their lack of objectivity. But understanding and being clear here, folks, when we're looking at this Constitution Republic, we are a law of nations, and we are under the rule of law. The law is our king. And so we, in this Constitution, where we have every state with their own supreme law, their supreme law must be congruent or harmonious with the U.S. Constitution. Now, every state in the Union has to also declare their legal system. The federal government has a unique legal system, which is based upon the Constitution. That's why I went down this earlier today. I went down the jurisdiction for the federal government was all based upon all things arising under that Constitution. Ergo, for your state to have jurisdiction in common law, it must be so stated in the state constitution. Now, every state that joined the Union while they were territories, they determined that the law of the territory would be common law. They didn't need to have a constitution. They declared it, and that's what they practiced moving forward, because common law is a legal system to provide justice for the people based upon the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution, based upon that. But justice is providing all those other things that may not be within that constitution, like the federal constitution. Obviously, they don't have anything regarding crimes, marriage, and those things. Therefore, because they didn't declare common law. When your state doesn't declare common law, it doesn't mean you can't be married. You can't have common law things. But the common law is left to the people. In other words, it's left to your counties. That is a different legal system than the state, just like the federal government has a federal court. The only thing that should be admitted into that federal court system, this is probably the most plain definition, plain clarity that you're ever going to get on this, that the only thing that would be admissible in your state legal system, in your state courts, are those things that arise under that state constitution. If it's not listed, they can't assume power over it. Is marriage listed? No. If they started, and actually here's the problem that we have with state constitutions. They have been modifying your state constitution based on the federal government's mandates. They've started creating environmental things. They've started creating labor laws. There was no way that most states actually added labor law to their state. That was all coming from the federal government. So we have the opportunity to determine, do you want the state to manage and maintain labor, or do you, because here's the problem, folks. Anybody that lives in the rural area knows that you can't have working hours for your children and your family because you're a part of the family business. You can't keep and hinder people from, you know, working in the wee hours of the morning because that's when the cows need to be milked. And if the state creates a labor law that says children will not be waken up and will not be put into work until they're a certain age, see my point? This is exactly what they've been doing to actually you attack the family. And it all started with this humanitarian, oh, well, we shouldn't be having our children do that. Next thing you know, they're starting to dictate religion and so forth and so on. So where do you want the majority of those types of laws and regulations to be? Do you really want the state to be dictating? Because the majority of the people of the state, and technically, the way we can protect us from really having a democracy, period, is making sure that any change to the state constitution comes from a majority of counties. A threshold, not 50% plus one, but at least a two-thirds majority of the counties must ratify an amendment. Therefore, you're going to start protecting yourself from the evil concepts of mob rule and socialism, communism, and so forth. Because Seattle, Portland, Chicago cannot rule your state anymore. They can only screw up their own counties. And when they, and you make it so they can't go into debt. So when they start actually having to decide, now see, doggone it, I got to cover this some more because there's still more I've got to cover. But if Chicago, you know, really wants to start telling you what you got to do, then they have to start choosing which money they spend, and they'll actually start taking away money for good because the bad precedence is far more important. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. Hopefully, we'll wrap this up on Friday. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.